Hi, I'm Tony Rossi for the Christophers, and on today's show, we're going to challenge your concept of mercy by sharing a story about a chaplain who ministered to people that most of us would write off as inhuman monsters. I'll be talking with Tim Townsend about his book, Mission at Nuremberg, An American Army Chaplain and the Trial of the Nazis. Stay with us. Christopher Close-Up starts right now. Hello and welcome to Christopher Close-Up. I'm Tony Rossi, and my guest today is Tim Townsend. Tim was named Religion Reporter of the Year by the Religion News Writers Association three times in the past decade, and he put his journalistic skills to work when writing his recent book about a largely unknown part of World War II and its aftermath. The book is called Mission at Nuremberg, An American Army Chaplain in the Trial of the Nazis. It relates the story of Chaplain Henry Gericke, who ministered to top Nazi officials imprisoned at Nuremberg before, during, and after their trials. Though many people wouldn't have deemed these men who orchestrated and committed so much murder as warranting any kind of spiritual guidance, Chaplain Gericke wanted to make an effort to save their souls before they were executed. It's a compelling and challenging story, so joining me now to tell us more, I'm happy to welcome to Christopher Close-Up, Tim Townsend. Tim, thanks so much for calling into the show today.
Well, thanks for having me, Tony. I appreciate it.
Now, if there are a group of people in modern history that are generally thought of as irredeemable, as not worthy of any kind of mercy, I think it's the Nazis. Yet, here you are writing this book about exactly that topic, about Chaplain Gericke and his mission to save their souls at Nuremberg. But before we get to his story, did you go into writing this book with any preconceived notions about what the Nazis in Nuremberg were like?
Well, I think mostly just from what I had read or seen in, you know, sort of the Hollywoodization of what the Nuremberg trial was.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I mean, I knew that these were the men who were on trial were the men who were being held responsible by the Allies.
Mm-hmm.
For what had just occurred over the last several years in World War II and the Holocaust. So, you know, my sort of layman understanding of who was responsible for all of that was pretty much like everybody else's. You know, you think of Nazi, you think of a bad sort of evil, the kind of stereotype of evil.
Yeah.
And so it is certainly what attracted me to the story is that the 20th century, if you ask somebody 20th century evil, connect those things, most people would say Nazi. And I think the fact that there was were these two men who were American and who decided to try to save the souls of these evil characters. That certainly opened my eyes when I found out about it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you just mentioned the evil thing, and one of the things that struck me about the Nazis in the book who were imprisoned, and you write about specifically one of them in the opening chapter, Wilhelm Keitel, who was Hitler's general field marshal. It's how their past, it's almost like it seems very average and innocuous and non-threatening for, you know, their past, and all of a sudden they take this journey to become monsters. What insights did you gain about why people like Keitel and the others, why did they suppress the goodness that was in them in order to become these really monsters in of history?
Yeah, that was pretty important to me in terms of telling the story. I wanted to be able to show, you know, as we were talking about the Nazis, you say Nazi and you think evil, but you do have to remember, and I think this is what these two pastors did, remember that these monsters were once children and normal men. Something happened to them along the way. And for me, you know, in researching the history a little bit, two things sort of jump out, and, you know, the German experience in World War One and after World War One was defining for a lot of these men. A lot of them fought in World War One and were defeated, and their lives, any German life after World War One, was pretty horrendous. And Hitler came along and sort of gave them this national pride back, and a lot of them were willing to do horrible things in order to sort of reclaim that feeling of national pride. And obviously things snowball at that point. And, you know, Hitler's overall influence on these particular men at Nuremberg, but obviously thousands and thousands of Germans, was sort of a overwhelming for them, and they followed him.
Yeah. I'm talking to author Tim Townsend about his book, Mission at Nuremberg, An American Army Chaplain in the Trial of the Nazis. And again, when you're writing about Keitel, I kind of got the sense that when he was in the midst of his Nazi life, it was almost like he forgot who he was early in his life. And then when he was in prison, Chaplain Gericke almost helped him find that again. Is that an accurate reading, you think, of his experience there?
I think you're right, and I think the experience of all the Nazis at Nuremberg split into people like Keitel who decided to sort of rethink their experience, and then other people like Ernst Kaltenbrunner, say, who just clung to what he knew as one of the henchmen of the Third Reich. And so there were some who were reflective and some who just sort of stood by what they had been and defended that in a way. And I think the people who were the men who were able to do the sort of reflection were the ones in the eyes of Gericke and O'Connor, the two chaplains, who were the most, you know, in their eyes, successful in terms of trying to reclaim a little bit of who they were before the Third Reich took hold.
Right, right. Well, you just mentioned Gericke and O'Connor, so let's talk about them a little bit. The lead character in this book, so to speak, is Chaplain Henry Gericke. One of the Nazi prisoners at one point refers to his faith as simple and his sermons as unpretentious. So tell us a little bit about the background of this simple, unpretentious man. What made him into the man in ministry he was?
Yeah, I think part of it is that he had lived a pretty full life. He was middle-aged by the time he even volunteered to go to war. He was 50 years old, or almost 50, when he entered the army in 1943. And, you know, he had been, he'd wanted to be a preacher since he was a teenager. He had seen the great evangelical preacher Billy Sunday when he was a kid, and that he knew that that's what he wanted to do. And as he, you know, he did the usual. He was a Lutheran. He went to seminary. He got out of seminary. He pastored a church in St. Louis. But then he did something really interesting. And during the Depression, he left this very comfortable, the confines of a very comfortable, normal Lutheran church, and decided that he needed to be on the streets helping people who were really desperate in St. Louis during the Depression. And he did that, moved his family out of the church housing and into a tiny little apartment, and did that through the Depression. And I think that was the first time, and that included actually people who were in jail.
Okay.
So a lot of that had a lot to do with what he eventually did at Nuremberg. But yeah, I mean, he was an evangelical before that word was really meant what it was today. And he was sort of the perfect person for a number of reasons to be the guy to lead this kind of chaplaincy in this very unusual situation at Nuremberg.
I'm Tony Rossi. You're listening to Christopher Close-Up. I'm talking to author Tim Townsend about his book, Mission at Nuremberg, an American Army Chaplain in the Trial of the Nazis. You just mentioned that Gericke was evangelical. And the one thing I also got from him and the others in this book is that he was also ecumenical before his time. He seemed to have a pretty good relationship with the Catholics he worked with. You mentioned the other Catholic chaplain. The Catholic chaplain at Nuremberg was Father Sixtus O'Connor. What was Gericke's background with kind of interfaith cooperation before that kind of thing was really, popular?
Yeah, I thought that was fascinating, too. He when the Gerickes lived at their church in St. Louis, St. Louis was a very Catholic town, and they lived in a parish, in the middle of a Catholic parish, and Lutheranism was kind of the number two denomination. And the Garrickeys, and especially Pastor Garricky, worked very closely with the Catholic priest of that parish. And, you know, they were friends with Catholics. They had just sort of the normal life of neighbors in a city in the 1920s. Mm-hmm. And so that experience, I think, of interfaith partnership in a way in that neighborhood very much helped him later, because he chaplains in the army are chaplains to all, not just for the men and women in their particular denomination. And so it very much helped him with other Christian denominations, but it also, I think, helped him in terms of his relationships with the Jewish members of his eventual army unit. And that was important to him, obviously, in a formative way, when he begins counseling and pastoring to Nazis.
Right.
In the wake of the Holocaust.
Well, tell us a little bit about his life before Nuremberg, because how exactly did he minister to soldiers during the war?
Yeah, so he was part of a hospital unit that went over to England, just sort of west of London throughout the war. So it was a really sort of one of those MASH type situations. They were getting all of the wounded coming from the front lines. So anybody who was surviving was flown into these bases just west of London. And his massive army hospital unit pretty much just patched people up to save them enough to put them on trains to get them to London to proper hospitals. So he spent his war as a chaplain both to the wounded men who were coming back from the front lines, but also to this giant hospital, all of the staff, the nurses and the doctors at this hospital. That hospital at the end of the war moved down from England into France and then finally into Germany, to Munich, where they set up camp in the months right after the war at a Munich hospital that had been bombed. The Allies had now taken it over. And for the summer before the Nuremberg trials began, Garricky was the chaplain of that. It was the same unit in England, but it was that hospital. And that's where the people who were sort of staffing at Nuremberg found him.
Right. Well, sometimes when people are confronted with witnessing that kind of suffering like he saw at the hospital, they can have a crisis of faith themselves. Did Chaplain Garricky ever go through that kind of thing?
Not that I know of.
Okay.
I think his experience and his age really helped him in a way, because he was sort of seen as the gray-haired, you know, little paunchy, you know, not, it's funny, in his, he didn't get great marks in terms of exercise, but he got very good marks in terms of morale and leadership. And I think his commanding officers looked to him as a sort of a leader in his unit, because people would go to him and they would talk to him. He was, you know, he was the pastor, and people who were afraid or who were missing home, or, you know, like a lot of chaplains, they become ears and shoulders to cry on. And I think he did that very well.
Right. Well, I mean, I see his picture in the book, and he looks like kind of a quiet, gentle man. And yet you say that he had a voice akin to Burt Lancaster or Robert Mitchum. So was there a toughness to Chaplain Garricky that also came across?
I don't know if there was a toughness, but there was certainly, I mean, his son, who is still alive and who helped me tremendously in writing this book, said that probably his father's greatest gift as a pastor was his preaching. He would spend a lot of time on his sermons, and he had a great delivery. And other people that I talked to who were children after the war, when he was back in the States and ministering in a church in Illinois, said that they remembered as kids that they felt like, you know, like any great preacher, that he was talking directly to them, that they felt he was looking directly into their eyes when he spoke. And I think that probably was very powerful, and probably was powerful for the Nazis, even though, you know, his German, he was fluent in German, but it wasn't great.
Mm-hmm.
Pastor O'Connor's, Father O'Connor's German was excellent.
Okay.
And Pastor Garricky's was sort of understandable. It was from his childhood and from school. So, but yeah, I think his ability to connect was pretty huge.
Now, you also write in the book that the decision to send Christian ministers to offer spiritual comfort to Nazi war criminals was, quote, possibly more controversial even than putting the Nazis on trial. So tell us a little bit, how did the world react to this idea?
Yeah, I mean, the Nuremberg trials themselves were a total experiment. Nobody had ever done anything like this before, where the victors decided, rather than just to point-blank shoot anyone that they enemies that they caught, which is what Churchill actually wanted to do, they would actually try to put them on trial and give them a fair trial and a hearing. And so that was in and of itself an experiment and controversial, because the Allies were essentially making up an entire new form of jurisprudence. But then to offer these people not just a trial, but spiritual comfort as they were on trial for the murder of millions of people. I don't know how much at the time people really thought about it, because the focus was pretty directly on the trial itself. But when people did find out about it, it caused a lot of consternation, and people wanted to talk about it, especially with Gericke when he returned home and started telling his story. But yeah, I mean, I think to give spiritual comfort to these men who had been part of the attempt at elimination of a certain religious group without clearly giving any of those people any sort of thought as they were dying was a fairly remarkable thing to do in one way. In another way, it's, you know, the Allies were trying to follow the Geneva Conventions.
Right.
And the Geneva Convention said that was necessary for prisoners of war. So in a way, it's a pretty easy decision. In another way, it's a very sort of philosophically hard thing to get your head around.
Well, now we've mentioned the Catholic chaplain, Father Sixtus O'Connor. Tell us a little bit about him and how he interacted with the prisoners there, because it seems like there's a little less information on him than there is on Chaplain Gericke.
Yeah, there isn't very much. There wasn't very much I could find about Chaplain O'Connor. What I found, I threw in the book. But he was he had a remarkable war. He was a younger guy, and he fought. And he was part of a fighting unit that marched all the way through Europe. And he wound up got a Silver Star for bravery, for counseling men on the battlefield. For what was then called battle fatigue, but we would now call post-traumatic stress disorder. As bullets were flying all around him, he was trying to help people through it. And at the end of the war, his unit actually helped liberate Mauthausen concentration camp in Austria. And so he buried thousands and thousands of dead and dying concentration camp victims in the immediate aftermath of the war. And 2 months later, in Nuremberg, was counseling, pastoring the guy I mentioned earlier, Ernst Kaltenbrunner, who was in charge of the entire concentration camp system. So Father O'Connor went from seeing the raw aftermath of the Holocaust for 3 weeks. He dealt with dying Holocaust concentration camp survivors and people who were dying, and then just a couple months later was ministering to the man who had been responsible for that.
Wow. What do you think it was in Father O'Connor and in Chaplain Gericke that made them so able to convey this kind of mercy? Because most people, I think, would just hate these guys who are locked up, as opposed to trying to see them as human beings and convey some kind of mercy to them. Was it simply the demands of their religion that they had learned throughout their lives?
I think so. I mean, I've thought about this a lot when spending these years writing this book, trying to figure out if I could even get my head around what they had done. And I could not have even walked into one of those cells, I don't think. And they not only walked in, but knelt on the concrete floor next to these men and prayed with them and tried to bring them back to some sort of belief in the church and in Jesus. And that was... it's an amazing thing to contemplate, and I think it is a testament to their both faith as Christians, but also to their abilities as pastors, that they, you know, knew that they had a particular responsibility and a calling that they took very seriously. And this was an extraordinary moment in history, and they rose to the occasion in a way that, you're right, I don't think a lot of people would be able to do.
Yeah. I'm talking to Tim Townsend about his book, Mission at Nuremberg, an American Army Chaplain and the Trial of the Nazis. Now, you're a religion reporter, so you may be familiar with this term being tossed about lately because of the Synod of Catholic Bishops. The word gradualism has come out about that people kind of grow in their faith gradually. And to me, I was reminded of that when I was reading it. I thought of your book because it seems like that's the approach that Chaplain Gehrke and Father O'Connor are taking with those Nazis. They're trying to gradually get them to kind of refocus their spiritual roots and sights on something higher in their own sins. Was this really a gradual process? Because again, these Nazis had committed all these war crimes during the war and committed things that, you know, are unspeakable. Was it really a process of gradualism for them?
I think for some of them it was. And I think it was very interesting to read about how Gehrke, especially because he actually wrote about this and O'Connor didn't, but Gehrke was pretty tough in terms of trying to catechize these men. I mean, it wasn't just, okay, if you say that you believe in Christ, I'll rebaptize you. I mean, mm-hmm. it was definitely a process that he took them through, and it was Sunday school in a way, you know. Which is tough to, when you know the pressures that they had, the time pressures, because they didn't know if the Nuremberg trials were going to take 3 weeks or 3 months or, you know, nobody thought it would even go 6 months, and it almost went a year. Mm-hmm. So it was a race against time. They knew that a lot of these men would be executed, and both chaplains were racing against that moment, trying to bring as many of the Nazis as possible back into the folds of the church before that execution date. So they both had to work both gradually so that they could be sure in their estimation that these men had been brought back to belief. But they also knew that there was a ticking clock before some of them were going to be killed.
Yeah. Well, why were some of the prisoners so unable to accept their own guilt at this point? Because some of them, it seems, that they said they would believe that they would be judged innocent by God. Was it just pride?
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, that's the big question, not just at Nuremberg, but made most famous at Nuremberg. But anytime anybody's on trial for any sort of crime against humanity, I mean, you can look at the Cambodia trials that are happening right now, or anything that happens at the International Criminal Court right now, and it's very similar. People almost always blame their superiors. You know, they say, "Well, if I hadn't done what I did, I would have been killed too." And so, what good would that have done? And that was sort of the main line that was taken by most of the Nazis when they finally were able to take the stand and defend themselves. Some of them got closer to taking responsibility than others, mm-hmm. but really in the end, nobody got up there and said, "I am responsible for my actions." Mm-hmm. And, you know, Gehrke, who knows what was said in the confessional? Neither Gehrke nor O'Connor ever betrayed that. Mm-hmm. Gehrke wouldn't even tell his son what these men said in sort of those times of private confession, years and years later. Mm-hmm. So nobody will ever know whether some of them may have confessed to one or other of the chaplains. But certainly publicly in that courtroom, none of them really took that final step toward taking responsibility.
Right, right. Well, my final question then, what do you hope people get out of reading this book, Mission at Nuremberg?
Well, you know, so much has been written about Nuremberg and about the Holocaust and about World War II, and I just sort of thought how lucky I was to find this very small story that obviously asks some really big questions that hadn't been told yet. And so my main hope, just as a journalist and as a writer, is that people read it for the good story that it is, and hopefully I told it well, and that these men really did this extraordinary thing on this huge world stage, and yet nobody really knows until now very much about them. And so my real hope is that people just read the book and recognize that that these two men did this extraordinary thing in the name of both, you know, sort of democracy and what the Allies and what America fought for, but also, you know, for their faith and how remarkable their faith is, that they were willing to share it with the worst people on earth.
I'm Tony Rossi. You're listening to Christopher Close-Up. I've been talking with Tim Townsend about his book, Mission at Nuremberg, An American Army Chaplain and the Trial of the Nazis. Like Tim just said, it's a small story that asks big questions, and it's a piece of history most of us don't know anything about. I appreciated reading this book and being challenged with its questions about mercy and forgiveness and good and evil, and it's an excellent read, and it's a fascinating, compelling piece of history that I think everybody should pick up. So pick up Mission at Nuremberg, An American Army Chaplain and the Trial of the Nazis by Tim Townsend. And Tim, thanks so much for writing the book and for talking about it today.
Thanks, Tony. MissionAtNuremberg.com. You can find out anything you want about it.
Great. MissionAtNuremberg.com. Got it.
Thanks so much.
Now, before we end today's show, here's a message the Christophers would like to share with you.
Throughout Scripture, we hear that God is kind and merciful. And we see in the stories of the gospel what that mercy looks like, as Jesus unpacks it for us via parables and practice. But how can we live out the concept of mercy in our world today? To answer that question, the Christophers have prepared a news note called Blessed Are the Merciful. It highlights the kindness, forgiveness, and love that result from practicing mercy and offers suggestions on ways we can integrate mercy into our lives. To request your free copy of Blessed Are the Merciful, send an email to radio@christophers.org or call our toll-free number at 1-888-298-4050. We look forward to hearing from you.
In closing, I want to thank all our listeners for tuning in today, and I encourage you to visit our website at christophers.org to learn more about the Christophers and to download free literature and podcasts. When you're there, you can also find links to our blog and our Facebook and Twitter pages. And if you have any questions or comments about the show, you can send an email to radio@christophers.org. Our engineer for today's show is Brian Bonifacio, and I'm Tony Rossi, your host. Thanks again for joining us, and remember that it's better to light one candle than to curse the darkness.